Good morning, Jack Grace, musician, our friend, takeaway contributor. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, John. It's great to be back.
We've missed you, yes. If this 2008 campaign, I've been dying to ask you this, were a battle of the bands, what two bands would these candidates be, do you think?
Let's see. McCain, I'm going to say sort of like the Kingston Trio.
Kingston Trio, with Olivia Newton-John on vocals, yeah.
And then maybe Obama's more like Radiohead and Biden's kind of like Steely Dan.
Nice. I like that. So Jack, I have a problem. I sang on the show yesterday. It didn't go over well. And I can't be doing that again.
But we talked about that.
Here's a ditty for our listeners that I wrote, and I want you to help me out with it, okay?
All right. Well, here we go. Goes like this. In 2000, you'll recall the Chad's Rectra campaign. It took such a terrible toll and left a lasting stain. What to do now, we all ask, how are those voter rolls? At least in 2008, we got America's exit poll.
And we got Jack Grace. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 24th, and I'm just so happy. Thanks, John. Thanks, Jack. Such a big difference when a real singer sings.
That was not necessary, but thank you, and good morning, Adora.
Today we're visiting the swing states that will determine our next president, and we're on the ground in Nevada, and a concert with more than 1,000 bands. Takeaway pal Jack Grace, the Martini Cowboy, he enters the music marathon. All that and plenty more, but first some headlines.
World markets in a free fall. Wall Street looks set to follow in just over an hour. Futures trading on the Dow and S&P have hit their lowest levels possible. That suggests a 12% decline at the open. Traders are betting the markets will tank. Asian markets are closed for the day. They had a brutal day. Key indices in Japan and South Korea more than 10% down. Japan hit a five-year low. South Korea had its worst week in two decades.
And OPEC is cutting production by 1.5 million barrels a day. OPEC President Shaquib Khalil says economic realities mean oil exporters have to make a move now.
They don't have a choice. What choice do they have? See the oil price go down to lower levels? I don't think they have a choice. So they'll make the cuts.
Despite the big announcement just a little while ago, oil prices have mostly slipped today. This on fears that oil demand will drop as the global economy suffers.
Here's a voice of suffering.
The crisis, however, has turned out to be much broader than anything I could have imagined.
Recognized former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan testifying in Congress yesterday, in sharp contrast to the rapturous reception he usually gets. He was had his judgment questioned all day by lawmakers. Pakistan has four men under arrest tied to last month's suicide attack on the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad. 54 people died there. A police spokesman says men were indirectly involved.
John McCain campaigns in Colorado. Barack Obama is visiting his sick grandmother in Hawaii and not publicly campaigning today.
So we're taking the pulse of voters with a pollster later, and he's looking at people with racist views who still support Barack Obama. But for now, we want to hear from you.
Finally, we found something and somebody who can transcend race, and I really don't think it's as important as you are all making it at all.
How important is race? Is it a positive thing? Do you vote because of race, or do you vote negatively against it because of race? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. On a normal day, an 8% slide in oil prices, an easing of the credit crisis, and a rising dollar might be considered good economic news, but there's nothing normal about these markets. And today, Wall Street is poised for a historic decline at the open at 9:30. But markets around the world have been tanking, and joining us to talk about it is Philip Coggan, who's a columnist and capital markets editor for The Economist. He joins us on the line from London. Before we talk about Wall Street, Philip, recap for us what's been going on as the sun has risen across the globe.
It's just been turmoil, John. The Nikkei, the Japanese index, down 9.5%. We've had markets in Europe at one point trading 10% down. They've recovered a little, but it's still 7 or 8% down. And we've just had plunges in everything. Gold has been plunging. Oil, as you say, despite that cut from the producing nations, that's down to less than $64 a barrel. It's down 11% this week alone. Stock markets around the world are down 45% this year, so basically have halved. It's very hard to find some good news in all this.
Well, you know, there's a signal-to-noise ratio problem in all these numbers, but I really need to ask you, are you seeing this as a continuation of redemptions and capitulation, market finding a bottom, or is there something strategic happening here which may have some very long-term consequences, Philip?
Well, there are two things happening, John. You're right that people are being forced to sell assets to clear their debts, hedge funds in particular, which are facing their clients wanting their money back, so being forced to sell. But the other thing is real concern about a global recession. I just want to throw two things at you. Volvo, which is the big Swedish car and truck maker, in the third quarter of last year had 42,000 trucks ordered. This year, 115.
Wow.
Not 11,115.
Wait a second.
Astounding.
You just said 43,000?
42,000 last year. This year, 115. Sony, 60% income drop this year. They've had they make TVs, digital cameras, that's suffering.
I've heard of Sony, Philip. I've heard of Sony. Yes.
Sorry. But it's that particular problem. The game station's fine. It's the PlayStation's fine. It's the TVs, the big TVs everybody was buying last year. They're not buying anymore. Peugeot's French car maker, it's slashed production by 30% going into the fourth quarter. So these, you know, we've gone from worrying about the banks to worrying about the global economy. There were figures out today which showed that Britain is in recession and effectively that most of Europe is now in recession.
Let's talk quickly about why the dollar and the yen are spiking and gold is at a 13-month low. You would expect at times like these that gold would rise.
Right.
Yeah. Well, gold, yes, you're right. You think when people are worried, but it's also a currency that people buy when they think the dollar's going to fall. But the dollar has been doing very well against every other currency in the world apart from the yen, where it's at a 13-year low. But against the pound, I've got my in-laws coming over from New York next week. Last year they came, it was $2 to the pound. Now it's one below 160. So that's good news for them if you're traveling to Europe this year.
It's good news for them.
And the other problem with everything else is simply that people just don't know. Some of these things may be bargains now. Shares, you know, are much cheaper than they were 8 years ago.
Philip, that's my question. Can these prices truly reflect the value of the companies?
No, they don't. But just remember, in 2000, you had silly dot-com companies with no profits and sort of barely a business plan written by a spotty 23-year-old who were valued at billions of dollars. Now we're seeing the reverse of that, people too frightened to buy rather than just, you know, over-enthusiastic to buy. So we are seeing fear dominate the markets and people just dumping and saying, I'll have whatever price you'll give me.
All right. Quickly, Philip, it's Friday. There's a historic decline posted, if you're going to believe the futures markets. Does Wall Street continue this horrible party, and is the weekend going to be pretty unsettling for all investors around the world?
Well, obviously, it's going to open very badly, and the figures are, you know, around 8,000. But let's hope there's scope for a rally. Warren Buffett wants to buy shares at these levels, and the authorities are going to have to do something. So I'm sure that they'll be watching and talking about further interest rates.
Well, by the end of the day, Warren Buffett may be able to buy the entire U.S. economy. Philip Coggan, columnist and capital markets editor for The Economist, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
But we're going to continue now with a voice from the campaign from Nevada.
I think the country is just looking for something very different. And that, it could be a gamble, you know. With higher taxes, and it's a big gamble. But
gambling, isn't that what Las Vegas is founded on?
That's right.
But it's not financial gambling that voter is talking about. It's political gambling. Voting is underway in Nevada. Barack Obama is visiting his ailing grandmother in Hawaii today, but his first stop back on the campaign trail will be Nevada tomorrow. And that's where our takeaway political director, Andrea Bernstein, is now. She's in Clark County. It's one of our counties that count. And, why the heck is Barack Obama in Nevada this morning? Good morning, Andrea. You must know the answer to that, yes?
Hello from Sin City, John.
Right. Well, yeah, it stays in Las Vegas is what they say, Andrea. But why Las Vegas? Why Nevada, do you think, for the Barack Obama campaign this time around?
You know, this state is so much in play. You can turn on the television and there are so many ads, just a huge pileup of ads. Sarah Palin was just here the other day. Barack Obama's coming tomorrow. And, you know, I think Nevada has been sort of stuck in people's minds as this reliably red state, even though Bill Clinton won it a couple of times. But, you know, people think, oh, Nevada, ranchers, cows, rugged individualists. But Clark County, where I am now, is one of the fastest growing counties in the nation. In 1980, so that's when Ronald Reagan were elected, there were just over 400,000 people here. Now, about 2 million, and that's about 70% of the entire state of Nevada. So what is happening is all these people are coming here, they're coming to Clark County, and they're influencing the politics of the whole state. And because it's such a growth area, what people are talking about here in Nevada, the fact that Nevada's in play, means that these sorts of issues are going to get onto the agenda of Washington. And just listen to this one voter, Devon Freeman. I mean, I was out at an early polling site. It's so easy to vote here. You can vote at the supermarket, at the mall. You can vote Saturday. You can vote Sunday.
At the supermarket?
Yeah. There's slot machines. Those
yes.
slot machines.
Yes. And they keep changing the supermarket. So if you're in a different market one day, you can go vote. And this was a whole family that had come, the Freeman family. They'd come with four carloads. And this is Devon Freeman talking about the vote that he just cast.
We just came and voted for Obama. And we're out the way. And we're done. We're done. We're just waiting on November 5th. At 12 o'clock at night to hear that vote.
Now, have you guys lived in Las Vegas a long time?
Yeah. Since 1983, I have.
Yeah. What is it that you love about it?
It's the money
the
city.
Weather.
The money city. You know if you ain't coming here, if you ain't getting money, you can't make it in Las Vegas. If you just want to come here and sit here and chill, you ain't going to make it because you got to be making money to live here. We working two jobs. Our whole family working two jobs. They did the same. Look, we live our whole life and our whole family work two jobs. He worked two jobs. I worked two jobs. My brother. My mama worked two jobs. She had a job for 20 years.
Well, that's a lot of Obama votes, it sounds like. So how did the McCain people make up their mind?
Well, there are a lot of people voting McCain for sure. I mean, there are people who said that they don't agree with Obama's fiscal policies. There are people who said that they don't trust Obama. They're scared of Obama. I will say that just about all of those people seemed to be Republicans. And Clark County right now, the voter board here says that the early voters, which is about 14% of the state voters, have been 2-1 Democrat in this area. And I met yesterday a Republican, and watch what is happening to Republicans. I spoke to this woman, Callie Sepetoris, just as she was walking into the polling booth. And I said, oh, well, have you decided? She said, no. And I said, well, come talk to me afterwards and tell me how you voted. So I was very excited. She just decided. Listen to her thinking.
I kind of just went with the military. I have family in the military. So I went with Obama to get them out so they don't have to spend more time overseas.
And what were you thinking as you went into that booth?
You know, I was thinking, wow, that's pretty cool, either a female vice president or, you know, an African-American president. Which history do I go with? So I kind of went against the female and went for the other chunk of history. But, like, again, it had to do with the military.
That's an amazing journey of thought to vote there. I guess I'm wondering, have you found any evidence in this so-called red state of the McCain message of redistributing wealth that we've heard so much for the last couple of weeks?
Absolutely. And I'm hearing so much of it that, you know, people are saying to me, he's a socialist, he's a socialist, he's a socialist. But yesterday I heard a pushback against that, which sort of tells you how the discussion has gone. This was from a group of women voters who had just voted, and they had voted Obama. And listen to what they had to say about socialism.
Let's see, we have Medicare, we have Social Security, we have a bailout and everything like that. That is, quote, socialism, if you get right to the definition of it.
Yes.
And it's called sharing the wealth, yeah.
Yes.
But all of a sudden you put a tag on somebody else, and he's it. It's just like when we were kids playing.
Wow, it's just like what you've been saying, Andrea. People are immersed in issues, and as a result, they're less vulnerable to being manipulated by all these slogan lines from the campaign. Andrea Bernstein, thank you. The Takeaway's political director in Nevada.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Later in the show today, we're talking to a pollster who says that people who hold, quote, racist views are still voting for Barack Obama. What do you think? What role do you think race has or is playing in this election? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now we're going to head overseas, where U.S. military officials say a coalition raid in Afghanistan left three insurgents dead today and four others in U.S. custody. Meanwhile, amid a rising tide of violence, Pakistan has announced a new initiative to fund tens of thousands of anti-Taliban fighters in the western border region. Pakistan is hoping to replicate a strategy that the U.S. has used, many say, successfully in Iraq. It's called the Awakening and basically involved recruiting tribal leaders to help U.S. troops. Joining us is Anand Gopal, the Afghanistan correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. Anand, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So who are these would-be anti-Taliban fighters?
These are basically local tribes that have armed themselves, actually independently of the Pakistan government at first. They've been pretty upset at the Taliban going into these tribal areas and enforcing their sort of really draconian interpretation of Islam. And so they've armed themselves and sort of taken law and order into their own hands in a lot of cases, including burning down the houses of the Taliban, etc. Pakistani government saw this and saw this as an excellent opportunity to sort of enlist locals in the fight against the Taliban. So now they've decided to throw some money and more weapons at these guys.
Let's talk about who they would be going after, because you've done a lot of writing about this notion of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, that they're not a monolithic group. Can you break some of that down for us?
Sure. There's what we know of as the Taliban is actually a couple of different groups. Of course, one group is Mullah Omar and these types that we've become accustomed to in the last few years. But there's also other groups that have different sort of associations with Al-Qaeda. So there's one group called the Haqqani Network, for example, that operates in Afghanistan, which is a lot of U.S. officials consider this group to be the most dangerous of all the insurgent groups because they're very close to Al-Qaeda. They engineer a lot of spectacular suicide bombings and other sorts of things. There are other groups that are more just like criminals that just have weapons. And in the sort of the lawless tribal regions of Pakistan or in some areas of Afghanistan, anybody with a gun and a grievance sort of calls himself the Taliban.
So it's just one group. How would this plan work, this Pakistan plan, to go after these groups?
Well, these groups are actually already the tribal groups that are fighting on behalf of the Pakistani government. They've been doing this for the last couple of months. And so the plan here is to try to give them more weapons and more money to go and to continue this. At the same time, the Pakistani military is trying to fight the war on its own behalf by sending in Pakistani soldiers into these lawless tribal regions next to Afghanistan and try to root out all the insurgents there.
And what has the Bush administration's reaction been to this? I would assume on some level they were consulted before the Pakistani officials announced this.
Yeah, they definitely were, and I think they're applauding it because this is looks to be the first real step to try to solve the problem here, because the Pakistani army's made a few incursions into these tribal areas in the past, but usually it's resulted in sort of peace deals between the Taliban and the insurgents there and the Pakistani government. So I think the U.S. officials are really looking at this and seeing this as a new step forward.
But do they believe that it will be a credible effort? I mean, certainly in the past weeks and months, there's been a lot discussed about the growing tensions between Pakistani officials as well as U.S. officials. I mean, we spoke recently to the former Pakistani ambassador to the U.N., and he called it a troubled relationship and that the United States essentially needed to overhaul its entire policy in the war in Afghanistan.
Well, part of the problem on the Pakistan side is that the Pakistani army's, like I said, repeatedly made peace deals with the insurgents. And so I think the U.S. is seeing a deterrent towards local militias perhaps is something that's more effective than relying just on the Pakistani army. In Afghanistan, the U.S. is also considering the same sort of thing that they've done in Iraq or what the Pakistani army is doing in Pakistan, which is arming the local tribes, setting up tribal militias to try to fight the Taliban.
How different is the Taliban from the sort of broader Pashtun kind of tribal allegiance, and how difficult is it for the Pakistani government or even the United States to attempt to separate out the Taliban allegiance with the Pashtun allegiance?
Well, it is tricky because there is a good deal of overlap between the sort of Pashtun tribes and the Taliban. But one of the differences is the Taliban and elements of the Taliban are close to Al-Qaeda. And there's a lot of foreign fighters like Al-Qaeda, a lot of Arab militants from Uzbekistan. And these fighters are the ones that really rankle the feathers of the local Pashtun tribes. A lot of them don't have a lot of patience for these guys because they're a bit more extremist than the local tribes are, and they often go around killing tribal elders and breaking all sorts of tribal customs. So there is some hope that perhaps we can drive a wedge between the local tribes and some of these foreign militants, and by doing that isolate some of the Pakistani and Afghan insurgents that are aligned to them.
Anand, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Anand Gopal, Afghanistan correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor, and he came to us from Kabul.
It's interesting how the fact that the Taliban use foreign fighters distinguishes them from the sort of tribal allegiances that might otherwise protect a group like that.
But it's going to be interesting to see how do you superimpose the awakening structure in Afghanistan, which is a very different cultural breakdown, ethnic relationship than what you faced in, what the U.S. faced in Iraq.
And as we learned with Osama bin Laden, a lot of those foreign fighters don't need the money. You know what I mean?
Okay, now we're going to do some headlines. Femi Okay has just joined us.
Thanks very much, Adora. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Congress is trying to figure out what's going on with the economy. The House will hear from analysts today about ways to create jobs. New unemployment numbers showed a larger-than-expected jump in Americans filing for unemployment help. Stock markets are way down all over the world. Wall Street looks likely to follow in a few minutes' time. And Dow futures trading shows investors betting on a massive drop in the market. OPEC is slashing oil production by 1.5 million barrels a day. The cartel made the move in an effort to boost oil prices, which are down by half since July. Little effect today, though. Oil prices are down amid dismal global economic news. Zimbabwe's leaders will meet on Monday in an attempt to break a deadlock between rival parties. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai agreed to attend a meeting with President Robert Mugabe. He boycotted a scheduled summit, saying the Mugabe administration interfered with his travel. Republican VP candidate Sarah Palin was asked about the role of vice president this week. It was a question that inspired Will Ferrell and Tina Fey last night.
The president can do nothing without checking with the vice president. That is why Sarah Palin...
Actually, Mr. President, I don't want to go all Katie Couric on you, but I think it's actually the other way around. I think the vice president reports to the president.
Really?
That was NBC Saturday Night Live Weekend Update Thursday, and back on the real campaign.
What are you going to do without SNL after this election? I don't know. Thank
don't
you.
Know. Help!
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Again, a reminder, after 8% and 9% drops in Asia and across Europe, Wall Street is poised for a historic drop at the opening. The futures market has limited down both for the S&P and the Dow Industrials. If the Dow Industrial Average would limit down when trading opens in an hour, it would mean roughly an 1,100-point drop in the Dow. We'll have more information on that later on in the program. But we don't want to follow the numbers. We don't want to ride the numbers. We want to do something different. That's why we invited our friend Jack Grace, a.k.a. the Martini Cowboy, to join us on assignment this week. We decided to send him, no, not to Wall Street, but to the 28th CMJ Music Marathon. It's a huge music festival in New York. And, Jack, what does CMJ stand for?
College Music Journal.
But only jerks use that. Everybody calls it CMJ, right?
It's an antiquated term, yeah.
Well, welcome back, Jack.
Oh, it's great to be back. Thanks.
1,000 bands, huge event, and we sent you over there. What's the mission of the bands that play at CMJ?
They come from all over the world, and they come in hopes. Basically, the whole world is a big random place where entertainment is discovered for not for its merit. And at CMJ, it's a place where it's condensed a little more. So it's still random, but it's in a smaller area, which is New York City.
And is it like Lollapalooza? Is it like, you know, Woodstock? How would you say it's different?
I'd say it's more that every club has a different themed showcase for the night. A lot of time it'll be like one club will have all Australian bands. One club will have all like art rock bands.
Didgeridoo clubs, any of that? No, probably not.
There probably actually are.
Probably actually are. All right. So every band wants to be the next big thing. What'd you find?
Well, you know, I sort of did a little, you know, investigating and found the industry buzz band. There were many, but one of the big ones was a band called the Phenomenal Hand Clap Band.
Now, that's off a CD. That's not their live performance,
this is
right?
A recording. Now, this is
that
the
sounds like Blondie, like the 2008 version.
Yeah, they definitely have some of that. They have a lot of disco, rock, dance music. And the interesting thing was the night was in a bigger venue, and the crowd was really dancing to a whole DJ beforehand. When the band came on live, all live instruments, mind you, the energy of the room definitely kind of went down a bit.
So they were a little bit of a disappointment?
I think that they're a band that might be a little more oriented towards recording, you know, so in fairness.
But clearly a buzz band, and they got the audience. Who else?
Okay. So then I did a lot of people were talking in excitement in a much smaller club was a band from Canada called Women. This is like, I think they told me that they were sort of going for a Jesus and Mary chain, and they threw even a couple of bands I hadn't heard of. And when I said, I kind of hear an early Piper at the Gates of Dawn, Pink Floyd, Arnold Lane kind of thing, they said, a lot of old people say that.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. But I like the fact that they've got a solid beat, and it's not this whiny indie stuff, which actually drives me crazy, no, I guess, because I'm an old person, right?
Yeah, well, you know what's really cool is they intentionally live, the vocals have tons of reverb on it. And that's a very not something that people do anymore, and it was really interesting. But they can really play live. We have a track of them playing live that we can pull up. You can hear this band can really interact live.
So the concept here is women and Canada. That's irresistible, I guess.
Yeah,
huh?
and the name Women, which is great. Mind you, there's no women in the band.
Thank you for saying
some
that.
Some people were actually like, is this going to be some boring Lilith Fair band? And I said, no, it's a psychedelic band called Women. And a lot of buzz, a lot of excitement going on, and I actually managed to catch up with the guitar player, Chris, for his take on all this stuff that's going on about them.
It still doesn't even make sense to me that I can play a show in a country that I don't spend much time in a city that I've never been in before, and people like my band. It's still kind of a mind bleep.
He's destined for a star on radio to know how to bleep himself.
Well, but what's interesting there is that there's a certain amount of real excitement, not a cynicism about the business. No. I'm wondering, I mean, in a moment where the recording industry is having all kinds of problems, here we have a very sort of authentic spirit of, hey, maybe I'm going to make it here. Is that what CMJ is all about?
They're having fun, and this is one of those bands that is seeing the benefit of CMJ. I mean, but the other side of it, of course, is that there's bands that travel from Chicago in a van overnight to get to CMJ and thinking that something's going to happen. And sometimes it's just as random as being out there in the rest of the world trying to make something happen. It depends who's walking up at what time, because they're meeting their friend for a sandwich.
Let's talk about the diversity of the festival. Sure. I mean, with 1,000 bands, you've probably got more than just rock and roll or psychedelic bands or, you know, sort of indie rock bands. I mean, there's got to be, you know, all kinds of stuff. Is there any hip-hop?
Yeah, actually, you know, there was a Canadian one right around the corner. I walked in, I saw some hip-hop, and it was really good, too. It's not my, you know, I'm not a good, well, worst in the hip-hop world, but I know when it sounds like they know what they're doing, and they
The festival, you know, spans everything. What about world music, that sort of stuff?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure, you know, if you look in the book there at CMJ or just go online to CMJ Marathon, you can just find, you know, there'll be a little of everything. I mean, there's over 1,200 bands playing.
What's the industry buzz this year? Is it get a contract? Is it do it yourself? Is it get a website? Is it distribute your own music? What are bands saying?
You can actually go for classes about every one of those topics at CMJ as well in the daytime. But the big question is really, does a label matter anymore, is one of the big questions. And nobody wants to answer it.
Nobody wants to answer it. What do you think? Well, you book bands.
I think right now the real question for myself as a musician and others is, it's not about the label. It's just like, how do you make money? How do you find the money out there? Because now the difference is there's so many different forms of media you can put music on. So how do you get your song in that little commercial on TV? How do you get some money for that? How do you get it? So the question is just, how do you make the money? Because people are still listening to just as much music.
What kind of turnout did they get? Did these bands get? Did have any sense of the numbers compared to, like, say, last year or the last time they had the marathon?
I was really impressed. I went on a Tuesday night and a Wednesday night, and all these places were mobbed with people outside.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's, you know, this is, mind you, I went to the area of New York City where there was a lot of condensed bands.
And, you know, which makes it sad for the poor bands that are kind of waiting in the wings. So tell me about this band here.
This band was another one from Canada that we're pulling up here. They're called Hey Rosetta, and we met up with them, and here's a classic story. They were supposed to go on at midnight. They went on sometime after 1 a.m. They came all the way from Canada to play, and they were just such nice guys that I just wanted to maybe give them a little plug, and let's hear what they really do sound like. And this is their chance on the radio here.
Jack, you're such a sweet guy, giving Hey Rosetta their break on the Takeaway.
They drove from Canada.
They drove from Canada. Well, it's not like they, you know, drove from Afghanistan. I mean, Canada is on the border.
Well, you know, when you get in a van with a bunch of guys like that, you might realize.
And you've been in some vans. Jack Grace, the Martini Cowboy, shaking down the CMJ Music Marathon. Here's Hey Rosetta.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
Space, a final frontier.
Okay, so for some of you out there, this story is kind of old hat, something you've been following. But for others, think of this as a public service. I mean, we want to bring you up to date on an intergalactic battle in the culture wars.
We'll be going to warp speed.
Aye, sir.
Course plotted for regular one, Ed.
Engage warp engines.
This story is all over the tabloids and the internet, and it begins simply enough with a wedding. The wedding of George Takei, star of Star Trek. He played Sulu in the series. He drove the Enterprise, and he was generally always taking orders from his captain, Kirk, William Shatner.
Mr. Sulu. Mr. Sulu.
Aye, sir.
What is our condition?
Sir, the braking thrusters have fired.
Anyway, George Takei was one of the first gay celebrities to take advantage of California's recent court ruling on same-sex marriage and tie the knot with his longtime partner Brad Altman. The couple was recently on CNN.
We want to be as inclusive as possible.
This is equality, and it's equality not only for Californians, but for everybody that wants to choose to be equal. So our state is wide open.
Okay, fine. That's the basic story. A wedding. But it gets really dicey when Sulu decided not to invite Captain Kirk to the wedding. William Shatner, in an interview with Ironsink.com, has been unsparing in his criticism.
Poor man. I there's such a sickness there. It's so painfully obvious that there is a psychosis there.
Whoa, psychosis? I mean, these guys drove the Enterprise through space. Shatner claimed to be deeply hurt that not only wasn't he invited, but the best man was Walter Koenig, Chekhov on Star Trek, and bridesmaid Uhuru, Nichelle Nichols. Shatner now goes for the jugular. First, he says, George Takei, who was that guy exactly?
I literally don't know him. I didn't know him very well on the series. He'd come in for a day or two, you know, as evidenced by the part he played. And then on the movies, there occasionally. I didn't know the man.
Kirk doesn't know Sulu? And then there's this photon torpedo. Sulu was just a pathetic, closeted gay.
Obviously hiding his homosexuality, talk about festering and not living the truth of your life and feeling badly about yourself and being fearful that somebody will find out this terrible, terrible secret, so he thought. Finally, at the age of, I think, 70, he decides to come out of the closet and say, I'm gay. Like, who cares?
Ouch. Well, here's George Takei's statement about William Shatner on his website. It is unfortunate that Bill was unable to join us for our wedding, as he indeed was invited to attend. It is our hope that at this point he joins us in voting no on Proposition 8, which seeks to eliminate the fundamental right for same-sex couples to marry in California.
Ready, sir. I know that none of you were expecting this. I'm sorry.
I'm going to have to ask you to grow up a little bit sooner than you expected.
Grow up? I don't know about that. Both of these guys are well into their 70s. At least we can say this. William Shatner knows a thing or two about psychosis.
In a boat, on a river, with tangerine trees and marmalade skies, somebody calls you. You answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
So much for the little trading booth.
Yellow and green, towering over your head.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Share prices around the world have been plummeting today. All major European indices are down between 7 and 8%, with less than an hour to go before the action starts on Wall Street. Dow futures point to a huge drop in American markets. OPEC is worried about falling oil prices. The cartel announced today they will reduce oil production by 1.5 million barrels a day, and this from an emergency meeting of oil ministers in Vienna. So far, oil prices have actually dropped despite the news, and this amid fear of a tough economy that will reduce oil demand. And finally, the average price for gas has fallen to 2.82 cents and a gallon. That's a gallon on average, according to the AAA, and that's down from a high of $4.14. That was the average back in July. That's a look at some of the main stories making news this morning.
That's huge. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So here at The Takeaway, we're asking you, our listeners, whether you voted early, and if you have, how did that process work? At America's Exit Poll, several Takeaway listeners have called in and are worried about their absentee ballots and whether they'll even be counted.
I voted in Florida by absentee ballot. The suggested postage on my envelope was $1, and my husband's envelope was $1.17. It was $1.17, so my envelope would have come back and my vote would not have counted in Florida. I think there's going to be another problem down there.
Interesting. but we wouldn't have jumped on this unless we gotten this call from another listener named Ruth from California.
Hi, this is Ruth. I'm calling because I heard about absentee ballots. My daughter lives in California, and she found out for my granddaughter's absentee ballot there was extra postage needed. And the postmaster told her hundreds of absentee ballots have been returned. Would you think the government would stamp on the envelope extra postage required? I'm very concerned about this. Thank you.
Well, we were concerned, too, but before we could jump on it, we got a call from Bob Shaw, a listener in Oklahoma.
My name is Bob Shaw, and I'm calling from Oklahoma. I'm a letter carrier, and I have I heard one of your callers complain that their mail-in ballots were returned for insufficient postage. I saw a letter in a post office that stated unequivocally that if a ballot, a mail-in ballot, was mailed with insufficient postage, it was to be sent to the local election office regardless, and that was the law.
So we took Bob's advice. We put out a call to Mike Canone. He's a U.S. Postal Service's representative from San Diego, California. And Mike says, well, are you listening, Linda and Ruth? Mike says Bob is absolutely right.
Voters can rest assured that their mail ballots will be delivered by the Postal Service to their registrar of voters, no matter how much postage is on it. So if it's short paid or non-paid postage, we have a national policy in the Postal Service that we will not delay mail ballots for any reason whatsoever. So there's no need to worry. The registrars have agreed to pay the postage due a later time.
Perhaps the Postal Service doesn't want to advertise it, but there's no problem with postage, folks. Have you voted early? How did the process work? Give us a call with your stories and any problems. We'll jump on them because we're America's exit poll at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
So hundreds of thousands of Americans are voting in these early voter states, postage problems, machines that don't work, long lines, clearly some issues that are coming up. So it's a good thing in those places. There's still time, and so they're getting fixed. And joining us now to continue this conversation is Heather Gerken, a lawyer with Barack Obama's National Election Protection Team. But today we're going to ask her to put that hat aside and put on her professor hat. She's also a professor at Yale University specializing in election law. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you for having me.
You describe the election infrastructure as being in scandalous shape. You want to explain?
We actually have one of the worst run election systems among any major democracy. It's usually underfunded, it's often run by amateurs, and it's sometimes administered in a partisan fashion. So the kinds of problems that we all saw as voters in Ohio and Florida actually occur pretty routinely. Ballots often get lost, there are often long lines, machines often break down. But the problem for most American voters is that we only see these things when elections are close, like the presidential races. In fact, what we have is a routine problem that occurs, as far as we know, almost everywhere. And that's what we've got to fix, because a turnout tsunami like we're seeing this year, like we saw in Ohio in 2004 and Florida in 2000, can occur almost anywhere.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. What's your take on these reports on early voting numbers and the historic direction they're heading in?
Well, the numbers are quite extraordinary. In some sense, it's very good to see people getting out now because it means that there's less pressure on the system on the day of the election. But I have to say that if predictions from past elections hold true, we are going to see incredibly long lines and lots of problems when people come to the ballot. The hope this year is that people are organized and they know it's coming. So I know that that people across the country, election administrators across the country, are doing their very best to address this problem. They're printing extra ballots. They're assuming they're going to have 100% turnout. So the well-organized election administrators are going to be fine. What I'm worried about is a place where people just aren't equipped for the turnout tsunami that's coming their way.
And do you have any particular places in mind for that? I mean, obviously, we know, for example, in Ohio, there have already been a series of lawsuits.
Well, it's a good bet that a swing state is going to have pretty high turnout. That's where all the ads are running. That's where all the turnout machines are for both campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always a good bet. The truth, though, and this is a sort of an extremely sad statement about our country, we don't know where the worst run system is in the country because we have absolutely no information on how well our system is run. We have less information about our election system than we have about most corporations, about how our baseball teams are doing, even about how well our dishwashers work. So this is a world of with no data. And when you have a world with no data, what it means is that the only way to assess a problem is when it occurs, as it did in Ohio and Florida. So it's a little bit like we're trying to measure annual rainfall by when a lightning strikes. What we need is the kind of information that tells us where the problems are.
So exactly. So what is your antidote for these very serious flaws?
Well, I think that at least the very first step is what I call a democracy index. So what we need is to get information on basic questions. How long did voters stand in line? How many ballots got discarded? How many machines broke down? The kinds of questions that matter to everyone. We need to gather that information together. And I think we should rank the states and localities based on how well they perform, just like the U.S. News and World Report does for colleges. Because what that would instantly give voters is something they can wrap their hands around. So voters don't care about what kind of registration system you use. They don't care about what balloting system they use. They want something to work.
But
and
Heather, why do you think that hasn't happened, particularly in light of all of the troubles 8 years ago in Florida?
Well, you know, the remarkable thing about the way our election system works is that even a national crisis like 2000, when Fidel Castro, who is needless to say not a man cursed with self-awareness, sent election monitors to Florida, if that couldn't get election reform passed, you know we've got a problem. I think the problem is that voters actually have no way to engage with these debates. So what do they see? They either see a bunch of people on both sides yelling at each other, or these incredibly arcane questions about whether OptiScan is it better than a DRE system? And I'll just say, you know, I do this for a living. I barely have the stomach for some of these details. So what we need to give voters is something they can wrap their hands around. And an index would do just that, because voters may not have an opinion about what the best system ought to look like, but they do have an opinion about whether they ought to be doing better than the state next door. And they do have an opinion about whether they ought to be ranked 49th in the country. If we give voters that information, mm-hmm. we give politicians a reason to pay attention. Right now, they really don't have a reason to pay attention. They do something that's a superficial fix, but the systematic problems that occurred in Ohio and Florida are occurring everywhere. We need to hold politicians' feet to the fire to fix that, and the only way to do it is to give voters something that they can wrap their heads around.
Heather Gerken, professor at Yale Law School, thank you. She specializes in election law, and she's also an advisor and member of Barack Obama's National Election Protection Team.
And she's going to be with us in an hour on our website, thetakeaway.org. We're talking about the voting process and how to fix it. Yale Law professor Heather Gerken will join us for a live Q&A. If you want to get your heads around the voting infrastructure process, it starts at 10 a.m. Eastern time. You go to thetakeaway.org. Quick look at the markets. As we said, Wall Street will open in a half an hour, and it looks like a limit down at the open, and that would mean a loss of 1,100 points on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That doesn't mean that's going to happen, but that's sort of the suggestion. We're always on at the Takeaway. We're talking about race and where it fits into the election. Here's what one of you had to say.
You know, as I've been talking with people about their issues regarding race and this election, one point that I've made is that the beauty of the privacy of the polling booth itself insulates everybody from that issue. If they believe that they can vote for the best candidate, putting America first, then it really doesn't matter.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And here is your takeaway for this hour.
And anybody with a gun and a grievance sort of calls himself the Taliban.
That's Anand Gopal, Afghanistan correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. If you missed anything, go on our website at thetakeaway.org, and you can podcast us each morning on iTunes.
I'm Adoree Doji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
So the polls are open, and the question is the lesser of two joys?
You know, I was thinking, wow, that's pretty cool, either a female vice president or, you know, an African-American president. Which history do I go with? So
early voters are rushing to the polls all across America, making up minds, standing in lines. Forget Election Day. Democracy finds its sweeps week. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adoree Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 24th. While there's lots of things we don't know about what's going to happen on November 4th, but it certainly does look like it's going to be a history-making year regardless.
We're making history all week with these early voting numbers. It's amazing. Good morning, Adora.
No, indeed, John. And we're going to hear today about where voters are rushing to the polls, record turnouts already. Plus, takeaway pal Ira Glass from This American Life, he's going to stop by. They're covering the campaign, too, and he'll give us a special preview of the next This American Life with stories from the swing state of Pennsylvania. But first, we have some headlines.
World markets in a free fall. Wall Street looks set to follow in a few minutes. Futures trading on the Dow and the S&P 500 has hit the lowest levels possible. In short, that means traders are betting the market will tank big time. We'll be watching and we'll tell you what happens in the early trading. One headline describes today's carnage in Asian markets as a train wreck. Japan's legendary bullet trains are fast and sleek, but today's nearly 10% drop in the Nikkei was slow and ugly. The key index is down a full 50% for the year. Other Asian markets also suffered comparatively.
Economists like to joke that a parrot could do their job. Just teach it to say supply and demand. Why do prices change? Supply and demand. OPEC knows that punchline well. They're taking a big step on the supply side this morning, cutting oil production by 1.5 million barrels a day. OPEC President Shaquib Khalil says countries must cut now.
They don't have a choice. What choice do they have? See the oil price go down to lower levels? I don't think they have a choice. So they'll make the cuts.
So oil prices should be up, right? Well, there's that demand thing, our PhD parrot tells us. Prices have actually gone down today in the $63 a barrel range. That's because of fears the tough economic times will decrease demand.
Adora, maybe you should be the Fed chief, but here's a prediction from a legendary economist who was very humble on Capitol Hill yesterday.
Given the financial damage to date, I cannot see how we can avoid a significant rise in layoffs and unemployment.
A forecast from former Fed Reserve Chief Alan Greenspan. He was testifying on Capitol Hill yesterday and got quite a grilling from Congress. Pakistan has four men under arrest tied to last month's suicide attack on the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad, where 54 people died. A police spokesman says the men were only indirectly involved. The investigation continues.
On the presidential front, John McCain talks to voters in Colorado today. Barack Obama is visiting his sick grandmother in Hawaii and not publicly campaigning.
The World Series is all tied up now. The Tampa Bay Rays beat the Philadelphia Phillies last night. The best of seven contests tied 1-1 game three Saturday in Philly.
We're conducting American's exit poll and we want to hear from you.
We've been hearing from lots of people with lots of questions about early voting, and we've solved some of your problems, so we want to hear from you more infrastructure issues. Have you voted early? Why did you vote early? How did you make up your mind? Give us your individual stories of democracy in action at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, if you've been listening to us, we've been making much of this America's exit poll business, but for a good reason. Early voters at poll stations all over America are standing in line as much as 4 hours to vote early. It's a historic experience, and we're taking a look at what the early voting experience is actually like, what it means to democracy, how people make up their mind. We're actually welcoming back to the program two people we've spoken with before. Chip Rousey is from Elberton, Georgia, and Ilya Davis is from Atlanta, Georgia, where the polls are open right now for early voters. Chip and Ilya, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Ilya, let me just ask you, people vote early because it's more convenient, you avoid the confusion of election day. Is that your experience in Georgia, Ilya?
Maybe for the most, but for my own purposes, I found it to be more politically expedient. It seems to motivate people when they see that there's an active democracy in practice. So they have a tendency to vote. Even if they had hesitation prior to this time, they have a tendency to be motivated to vote.
Well, what do you,
the fact that so many people are voting.
What are you seeing at the polls down there in Atlanta?
Extreme crowdedness, 1.5 to 2 hour waits.
That's incredible.
Exactly. So, and oftentimes it's before the polls open that they're waiting an hour to 2 hours.
Have you voted yet?
No, I'm a college professor, so to find 1.5 hours to 2 hours to wait has been a problem.
So early voting, the lines are so long you can't even vote. That's incredible.
Exactly.
Chip, how about, what's your experience?
Hey, it's great up here in Elver County. We're a small rural county, and our early voting, although it's busy, we don't have a massive line or anything. We've got out about 20% already of our vote. During the primary, during the summer, we only had 12% even voting. But we've already got out 20% of our vote, early vote. I have early voted. I'm also on the Democratic chair here in Elver County, so we have to validate the vote on voting day. But also, it's practice what we preach. You know, we've been telling people, get out to early vote, get out to early vote. Well, the Republicans are typically early voters here, but we're running 50-50 Democrats now.
That's
incredible. We're gonna really come around.
And we've been finding that sort of thing all over the country. Well, Chip and Ilya, we spoke with you in early February on Super Tuesday. Chip, begin with you. How has your notion of the campaign, your mind changed at all between February and today?
Well, in February, you know, we started off, back in 04, we were big John Edwards people, and we were following John. I think that his part of him being in there has created a better policy for we went to Hillary and Obama, but now Obama, and our whole family supports Obama. You know, we've got about eight votes in our family, and my daughter worked on the campaign.
An eight pack for Obama there, Chip. Ilya, how about you?
I think I'm pretty consistent. I probably many of his other issues now resonate with me. Before it was international affairs, and now some of the domestic affairs have been very interesting to me, and so I've been motivated by a more global approach to his system now than I had been before.
Interesting. And, you know, it has been such a long campaign. I gather both of you made up your minds a long time ago, so early voting makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. And it provides you the opportunity to go ahead and celebrate the fact that you can make a part of the democracy. You can enact that part immediately.
Well, Ilya, when you finally vote, we want to have you back on the air. And, Chip, you're going to be busy on Election Day, so I think we're going to be talking to you as part of our election coverage. Are you down for that?
Of course.
Yes.
All right. Thanks so much, Chip Rousey and Ilya Davis from Elberton and Atlanta, Georgia, respectively, early voters in a state where the polls are open and there are two-hour waits to get to the early polls. Adora?
And that's not just in Georgia. So far, the reports coming out of early voting states are simply stunning at the experts. Numbers of people voting breaking records from Oregon to Georgia to North Carolina and Florida. Some counties have already doubled the number of early voters compared to 2004. And Paul Gronke, it's a fascinating year.
It is, and very exciting.
Paul Gronke is the chair of the political science department at Reed College and joins us from Portland, Oregon. So 2.2 million ballots have already been cast, and that was just as of Monday. There's talk now that potentially the turnout could surpass the 64% record in 1960.
That's right. In fact, one of my colleagues, Michael McDonald at George Mason, is saying we might have the 100-year storm here. We might pass the high water mark of 65%, which occurred, I believe, back in 1904 or 1908. So this is quite an election, and I think they haven't built the dikes high enough, and we're seeing a lot of overflow into the early vote.
Where is the heaviest turnout? Do you know, or do you have a sense, or do you think it's all been, the information has been released yet?
No, that's very difficult to track, Adora, because, you know, many states are good to give us statewide numbers. Still in many states, you have to go county by county. We do know that everywhere that early voting is occurring, we're seeing records broken. North Carolina is already double. Georgia statewide has already passed a level of early voting in 2004. Now, there is a possibility. The possibility is that there's been this pent-up demand, pent-up excitement. A lot of early votes are occurring now, and Election Day voting may be lower. I don't expect that to happen, but that is a possibility.
Let's talk about this trend. It really is a reverse trend because in the past, GOP voters have been the ones most likely to vote early. This time, though, Democrats are heading to the polls in big numbers. And tell us about some of the other interesting threads here.
Well, that's exactly right. That's what it looks like. In 2004, the best data that we have, which is from a survey, but it's a very high-quality academic survey, shows that George Bush won the early vote 60% to 40%. And there are states where the numbers look fairly balanced, in Iowa, for example. But in Georgia, for instance, where African Americans make up 29% of the electorate, in previous years they made up 22, 23% of the early vote. This year it's up to 35%. In North Carolina, as I said, the turnout has doubled, but the Democrat and independent turnout has more than doubled, and the GOP turnout is up as well, but it's only up about 60%. Now, as I say, it's possible that the African Americans are casting those ballots for John McCain, that the Democrats in North Carolina are voting for John McCain, but I don't expect that's happening.
Also interesting in some of the numbers is that the majority of early voters have been women.
I did not know that. I haven't seen those kind of breakdowns. But
in North Carolina, 56% are women. Georgia, also 56% women. What do you think we can read into any of these tidbits as we always try to read the tea leaves?
Well, you know, I've tried to be nonpartisan here. I don't work for either of the campaigns. And I've tried to spin this in some way that it's a positive positive for the Republicans. I think the easy read here is that this must be good for Obama. But I think there's a couple things to consider. One is certainly African Americans. This is an historic election. As one of your callers just said, this is like a Christmas present that arrived 2 weeks early. And you know what? Some of us just can't wait. They're opening the present. They're not waiting to put it under the tree. And I think for African Americans, there's a very good possibility we're seeing a lot of pent-up demand to cast a ballot, in all likelihood, for Barack Obama. And we may not see some of those people on Election Day.
I think that's a fair read of the enthusiasm of our two guests earlier. But, Paul, let me sort of bring a more sobering issue here to the table. I mean, you mentioned the dikes may not be high enough, which raises the issue, what part of the infrastructure is most vulnerable in these kinds of turnouts, both in the early voting, taking care of those ballots, and on Election Day?
Well, I think that's right, in the early vote. What I have recommended to election offices is to make sure, if they've particularly allowed no-excuse absentee balloting, that they have the infrastructure in place to simply store the ballots, John. I mean, there is just a physical necessity here. Imagine you get 10 pieces of mail on the weekend, and suddenly I try to put 10,000 pieces into your box. You've got to be able to process all that mail. You've got to have the rooms. You've got to have the letter openers. These are much more serious than you realize. You know, on Election Day, I think the problem is not probably going to be the infrastructure. It's going to be handling the lines, making sure that voters do not get discouraged. You've got to have backup machines in case machines break down. You've got to be ready to be open late, like we saw in Ohio in 2004. There's certainly going to be people waiting in line, and you don't want voters to walk away in frustration or disgust, or people with busy lives, and, you know, just as, again, one of your callers said, simply can't wait in line that long.
Professor Paul Gronke, we've enjoyed having you on our show.
All right. Thanks very much.
Paul Gronke is the chair of the Political Science Department at Reed College.
And a lot of people have thoughts about early voting.
I was happily going to vote in the general election and then realized that I would be on a cruise ship on November 4th. So I applied for my absentee ballot about 3 weeks ago, got it very quickly in a few days in the mail, and sent it in.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Tell us your early voting story and have fun on your cruise.
I know. I was just about to say, I think it's going to be a lot of people wishing they were on a cruise come November 4th.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. In this already historic election, we've had a number of historic narratives. Certainly there was the Clinton narrative. Could Hillary be president? Should she be president? Would she be president? There, of course, is the Barack Obama narrative, first African-American president. But, you know, it's not about sex and it's not about race. The narrative of Sarah Palin is center stage regardless of the fortunes of the candidate, John McCain. Sarah Palin has been an obsession of the media and of American voters since she was nominated as the running mate for John McCain. Last weekend, she was on Saturday Night Live, which gave her a big bounce. By Wednesday, there was talk all over the internet and on the news programs of Palin's high-end shopping spree, apparently $150,000 spent by the McCain campaign on her clothing. There's the wild ride with a stop to Alaska to give her Troopergate deposition in a case that's going on in Alaska. There's no end of Palin news, but how is the media handling this, and what is the Palin narrative, really, if we're going to take a serious look at it? Joining us now is Emily Rooney, host of the television show Greater Boston and the Media Roundtable program Beat the Press on our partner WGBH and PBS. Emily, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, John, an old colleague of yours from
and
ABC.
That's right, a former executive producer of World
News
Tonight. That's right. Emily, the Palin narrative is about more than sex. It's about more than class. It's about more than youth. What do you think the Palin narrative is, if you were to sort of give it a succinct kind of caption?
I'll give it one word. It's about uncertainty. This is a woman that no one knew a single thing about. And with uncertainty comes all these things, you know, including rumors and background checks. Every other candidate, including the 8 or 9 or however many candidates were in the Democratic, in the Republican, I guess there was about 18 of the candidate, everybody who were in the primaries, had a known quantity to them. Even a guy like Ron Paul had a known quantity. She came in completely naked in terms of that. So instantly you had and some responsible and some irresponsible media reporting things about her that were not true. And there's a lot of reeling back and apologies and mistakes made in the beginning, you know, even the stuff about the baby being actually being her grandchild, that kind of stuff. But now once that first sort of rollout went away, the serious stuff of her background really, really took place. And everybody else had been vetted. Everybody else had had these profiles done up about them ad nauseum, not so her. And when you get into a race that early, that was one of the dangers of A, picking an unknown, and B, picking somebody so late in the race. It used to be that the VPs were, you know, first of all, the conventions were a lot earlier, and the VPs were known by then. So the summer was over, and, you know, the gun goes off after Labor Day, and suddenly she was front and center Labor Day, and that's when the media started taking off on her.
It was
her.
All about guns and moose, and from the lilt of her voice to the kinds of things she said, Palin has been an obsession. Let's remind ourselves of the Palin-esque qualities of Sarah Palin.
I like being able to answer these tough questions without the filter even of the mainstream media, kind of telling viewers what they've just heard.
You know, Emily, as sort of cautious as I am about the notions of Sarah Palin's qualifications and maybe her positions on the issues, there is, even to this moment, a quality of her like, man, she's in the ride of her life, look at her go, and that fuels this on some level.
It did, and that's part of the charm of it. And I think the mainstream media has actually given her a ride on that. They've made her. She's been on Saturday Night Live. How much more mainstream media could you get? That quality of hers that is very kind of Obama-esque in a way. She's got the same kind of crowds, the same kind of appeal, same kind of enthusiastic supporters. One of the reasons people know about it is because they see the way she comes through the television when you get right down to it, or the radio because of the voice. That's why people they connect with her in a way.
But has this campaign obscured her message? Newt Gingrich has said the way the mainstream media has dealt with her is unfair. Palin herself expressed frustration in talking to James Dobson that basically it makes a caricature of her and doesn't allow her to state her positions on the issues.
But part of that was their doing. You know, they rolled her out in bits and pieces. Instead of just getting it over with all at once, have a mainstream press conference, they decided to manage the rollout, and frankly, it backfired. They started with Katie Couric.
They started with Charlie Gibson,
and then with Katie Couric, and then they went to Brian Williams, and he did it piecemeal, instead of just doing it all at once. And I think they were surprised by, they thought, you know, giving these lengthy interviews, they really didn't realize the way these things were going to be chopped up. And things are always cut up in a way that works best for the format of the broadcast. And in a half-an-hour nightly news broadcast, they're going to put things out one at a time that break news. And that's what happened to her. And I think she felt kind of burned, especially by Katie Couric.
But, Emily, I find some of this, all of this talk about the media and the coverage of Palin a bit absurd on some level, only in that here you have a vice presidential candidate. Voters are the ones who are going to decide whether or not they should give her that job. Therefore, voters should know something about, A, what she's done in the past as mayor of Wasilla, as governor of Alaska, and so on. Now, clearly, not every media outlet has done a good job. Most have tried, but as you say, there's been such a limited access to her. How much do we really even know of her if we took all of her public statements during the past 6 weeks and just lined them up? It wouldn't be much other than the speeches that she makes on the trail.
You know, but when you think about it, all of the responsible, anyway, media in this country have been to Wasilla. Everybody's gone there and looked at her track record as governor, looked at her track record as a mayor there. So if you really want to know some of the minutia about anything, or her position on energy policy, it's all there. But she is a huge persona.
And
that's the thing that people are focusing on. And she's not kind of letting that go away either. That's sort of the reason why she's risen to this level. It's all about her persona. So her record has been marginalized even by the McCain people.
She's driving it. The campaign is driving it. The question on Election Day is how much that profile is going to affect the actual vote for the Republicans. John McCain, my takeaway from what you said is that the vetting at the end of the campaign sets her apart from every other candidate because it's been such a long campaign. Emily Rooney, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Adore.
Emily Rooney hosts the television show Greater Boston and Beat the Press from our partner WGBH in Boston.
And now we're going to
have headlines.
Do some news.
Okay,
with Femi OK. Hello, I'm Femi OK. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. The Dow Industrial Futures are way down, which means a low opening on Wall Street. That's just a few minutes away. And this after a dismal day for markets around the world. Japan's Nikkei hit a five-year low to close down almost 10%. And four Pakistani men are under arrest in connection with last month's suicide bombing at the Islamabad Marriott. Pakistani police say they were indirectly involved in the blast, killed 54 people. And Zimbabwe's leaders will meet on Monday in an attempt to break a deadlock between rival parties. Quick look at your news headlines for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. After a fairly terrifying morning in the futures market, the Dow Jones, Wall Street is open, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 4%. That's similarly on the S&P 500, down 4%. And the NASDAQ has been flirting with dropping below 1,500 for the first time in quite a while. That's the market recap. We'll have more later on the program.
The Public Radio International show This American Life has spent the last month in the ultimate political battleground state of Pennsylvania. The show's mission was to find out why both presidential candidates think they can win there and to meet some of the folks on the ground campaigning. I'm very pleased to welcome This American Life host and executive producer, Ira Glass. Good morning, Ira.
Good morning, Adora.
So does the McCain campaign know something that the polls don't? For weeks, Obama's been trending upward there in Pennsylvania, and the latest polls show him 11 points ahead.
11 points ahead, but remember, a week ago, he was 15 or 16 points ahead in many polls. And so what the McCain people say is this is one of the places in the country where he is tightening the race. They say we have the momentum on our side. And they say that they, in their private polling, that they see the gap as just being 7 or 8 points.
Okay. What did you find is happening there in Pennsylvania?
Well, it's interesting. The targets of opportunity for McCain are two areas. One is moderate voters in the suburbs around especially Philly, and there's a lot of people like that. But the other target, and this is really where they think they have a shot at the state, are Reagan Democrats, working-class Democrats, who went overwhelmingly for Hillary in the primary. Remember, Hillary won by 9 points in Pennsylvania, and a large part of that vote were these working-class voters. And so McCain has really targeted those people. In fact, one of our producers, Nancy Updike, went out with this group called Democrats for McCain, door to door in Scranton, which is an area like this. And she found that as they went door to door, the thing that struck her most was how just incredibly soft the support for Obama was there. It's almost like people were waiting for someone to come to the door. She especially, one of the most interesting scenes in her story, she goes door to door with these two African American Democrats from New York who are Hillary supporters, and they go door to door in this white working class neighborhood, and they basically say to people, look, I was for Hillary, you were for Hillary, here's why I'm voting for McCain. And to have a black person show up at your door and say, yeah, it's okay, you're not racist if you vote for the white guy, as Nancy says in her story, it's like she was releasing them. It's like they were releasing them from handcuffs, and people just really crumbled.
Releasing them from handcuffs. There certainly is a twist there.
You know, Ira, the question I would have for you, though, is does the McCain campaign have the resources to scale that kind of door-to-door operation with enough voters to actually make a difference if it's the kind of thing that they can find all over the state?
I mean, that's a real question. The Obama forces definitely have a better ground operation. They've got 80 field offices versus 50 for McCain. They've been in the state longer. It's a much more vigorous field operation. And what you're saying is a real question.
And 10 days just doesn't seem like a whole lot of time to make that much ground. I mean, what's your thought there, Ira, based on the reporting you guys did?
I mean, at that point, anybody's guessing. You know, I mean, nobody really knows. I mean, both sides, you know, have their stance, but nobody knows how it'll play out over 10 days. Can I talk about another interesting thing we saw? Do we have another minute?
Absolutely.
One of the things that we'd heard about is there's a guy named Richard Trumka, who's the treasurer of the AFL-CIO, who's been going around giving this speech to unions about how unions have to confront the race question. And you can see this on YouTube. It's sort of a little YouTube sensation. It's been covered in the news. This is a very inspiring speech where he says, you know, we have to get in front of this. Many of our members aren't going to vote for a black guy. We have to confront them. Here's how you do it. He sort of demonstrates how to do it. And so one of our producers, Lisa Pollack, was curious to see if union people were really taking his advice. And she spent the last month basically tracking down union members to see, are you having these conversations? Are you confronting the question of race? And she found all sorts of people who said, yes, they absolutely are. She found a lot of union guys who said, like, you know, they've been more active campaigning for Obama with their own coworkers than they've been with anybody else. I'll play you a little clip. This is a guy who basically talks about one of his coworkers who simply said, like, I'm not going to vote for that guy. That guy is a black guy.
And he goes, well, dude, that's the way it is. You live your life, you see things the way you do, and I see things the way I do. I said, yeah, but Mike, you've got to get past this not only for this election, but with your life. I mean, you got to, you know, you work with black guys, you know, with several people that we know, and you know, you never have a problem with them. And he goes, well, they're, you know, they want the job. I've got to work with them. I kind of wish I hadn't gotten into this the way that I have, because it's shown me sides of people that I've worked with and known for many years that I had no idea were like this.
Yeah.
Wow. It's kind of 12-stepping them out away from racism, it sounds like. That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think when Obama, started doing so well, it seemed possible that we would have a big national conversation about race, which really hasn't happened, except, I think, in settings like these, where people have taken it upon themselves one-on-one to talk to coworkers, friends, family about it. Like, that's the location where it's happening, I think.
Huh. So, days away, 10 days until the election, and Pennsylvania could very well be caught right in the center of how the and it all ends up.
Well, very much. I mean, and both sides are still gunning for it. McCain spent just a shocking amount of time in the state. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, especially given the fact that, I mean, he was there three or four times this past week. Hold on, I have a list here. I mean, it's like his wife is there, Palin is there. It's three or four times a week they're there. And what's interesting is that this is a state which went for Kerry in 2004. Basically, Democrats have won it for the last four elections. But with the electoral math, he needs Pennsylvania to win if he's going to lose some of these, you know, usually reliably red states like Colorado and others.
Well, maybe as a backup, he could run for Senate in Pennsylvania if he stays there. That one, he'd take up residency.
Hey, Ira, when does your special air?
It's this weekend all over the country.
Thank you very much, Ira Glass. It's been great to speak with you.
Nice to talk to you guys.
That was Ira Glass, This American Life's host and executive producer. Now we have headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much, Dora. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The markets have performed really badly across Europe and Asia this morning. Just looking at the US markets, they've been open for 10 minutes or so. The Dow is down around about 400 points, S&P down about 48 points. Oil is trading at about $63 a barrel. That's down despite OPEC's efforts to boost prices. The cartel announced a 1.5 billion barrel a day cut this morning. And another Bush White House insider is backing Barack Obama. Former White House press secretary Scott McClellan says that he supports the Democratic ticket. McClellan's ties to President Bush go all the way back to Texas. And since leaving the White House in 2006, he wrote a best-selling book critical of the administration. The voting lines in Atlanta for early voters are really, really long. One poll worker in Marietta, Georgia, has been going down those lines telling people the bad news.
It's about a four-hour wait.
4 hour wait?
Yes. Yeah, I'm not sure you're it's not for me to decide. Now, but one thing I want to point out is that there are five other polling places opening Monday morning, and they're open all next week.
As that worker said, Georgia counties will get additional places for voters to vote. And according to Reuters, 3.6 million Americans have already voted. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And with markets crashing all over the world and credit crunch, loans not available, economic hard time, Alan Greenspan calls it a tsunami, how does America's economic difficulties get reflected in America's popular culture? Well, if you look at the top movies this week, Max Payne, that's one of them. Could that relate to the economic difficulties we're having? Or how about this movie?
I'm a chihuahua. Chihuahua.
Chihuahua. Beverly Hills Chihuahua. It's raked in $70 million in 3 weeks. So what's our expectation? Do movies reflect the times, or are they an escape from bad times or economic difficulties? Bill Gettyberry is film critic for New York Magazine, and he joins us right in the studio. Thanks so much for coming down.
Thanks for having me.
Do we expect movies to be an escape, or do we expect movies to in some ways reflect what's going on? Actually, the Iraq War is a bit of a kind of a model there.
Yeah, I think we expect both, to be honest with you. And in terms of Hollywood, you know, there are two kind of prevailing and competing philosophies when it comes to things like hard times. One of them says, well, people are having difficulty. They want an escape. They want escapism. They want to go into a movie and forget their difficulties.
Chihuahuas.
There you go. And then the other philosophy says, well, this is in the news. This is on people's minds, and we should cover it.
And in 1941, the Depression was very much on people's minds in this movie, Sullivan's Travels.
I want this picture to be a commentary on modern conditions, stark realism, the problems that confront the average man.
But with a little sex.
A little, but I don't want to stress it. I want this picture to be a document. I want to hold a mirror up to life. I want this to be a picture of dignity, a true canvas of the suffering of humanity.
But with a little sex.
With a little sex in it.
So how does that movie, follow the rule?
Well, Sullivan's Travels by Preston Sturges is kind of the ultimate movie about this dilemma. It's about a producer who is known for making very populist comedies, and he wants to make this very serious movie about people suffering. And to do so, he kind of dresses up as as a poor person, basically, right, and goes out into the country to experience it. And what he discovers is that very often people who are experiencing hard times want to get away. They want to laugh. At the same time, the movie kind of has it both ways, because it does show the dark side of life while at the same time kind of giving us this very optimistic vision of what the Dream Factory can provide.
But a complex movie, a sophisticated movie that really deals with all sides of this. So a lot of people, though, you say Wall Street to them, and they think Wall Street.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence.
So there is the movie Wall Street, which is about greed and very much about the stock market problems in the 1980s and successes.
Well, yes, and I think that's another example of where Hollywood could go and what Hollywood sometimes does right. If you look at Wall Street, it's on one level, it's a great popcorn movie. It's got good guys, it's got bad guys. And on another level, it's actually a pretty complicated film. It,
right.
it doesn't dumb down, or at least doesn't dumb down financial realities as much as it could.
And it was very, very popular. Bill Gatebury is a film critic for New York Magazine. The question for all of you is, what's your movie for economic hard times? Is it Escape, or is it more documentary? Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us.
I'm a chihuahua.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 24th. Femi Okeh has just joined us with some headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. John Adore, can you see the markets for me? Wall Street is trading at, how are we doing right now?
A little more than 5% down on all three indices, although the NASDAQ was down very, very severely earlier, and now it seems to come off its lows.
Thank you very much for that update. Also getting news in of PNC Financial Services Group, and they will buy National City Corporation for approximately $5.2 billion. And the merger will create the fifth largest U.S. banking deposit franchise. In Washington, Congress is trying to figure out what's causing our financial troubles. Today, the House will hear from analysts about ways to create new jobs. Recent unemployment figures show that joblessness is increasing more than expected. A suburban St. Louis school is providing voluntary HIV testing to all of its students. The decision came after an infected person said that as many as 50 students may also be HIV positive. The scare put the school in an uncomfortable spotlight. Another high school initially refused to play its football team. Tests will be anonymous and voluntary. And finally, I don't do this very often, but I'm just going to dip into a newscast from 1929.
It's over. All over, as stocks go down, down, down.
I know, I should be cheering you up, actually. But today is the 79th anniversary of what many regard as the start of the Wall Street crash. The initial crash happened on October the 24th, 1929, followed by a catastrophic downturn and a collapse that lasted an entire month. The economist Richard M. Salzman said that anyone who bought stocks in the mid-1929 and held on to them saw most of his or her adult life pass before getting back to even.
Wow. Was there really news behind that, or music behind that newscast?
There was.
Wow.
Should we try that?
So we should try that.
Yeah,
you do it a lot, though, actually.
Happy music behind
something.
Black Friday.
Shostakovich. Yeah. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
So, as Femi Okay was mentioning there, we have very severe numbers downturn on Wall Street. The White House said today that it doesn't comment on daily market fluctuations, and perhaps that might be good advice for us, but it certainly motivated us to get our pal Jim Ellis, Assistant Managing Editor at Business Week, on the line. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Is it responsible for us as a news organization to ignore daily market fluctuations when they're as severe as this?
I mean, I think that we have to go ahead and, A, report the news. I mean, people need to have the information. But more importantly, this is of such magnitude now, and it affects so many average people simply because so much of their personal wealth is tied up in the market, not so much through stock ownership for a lot of people, but because of their 401k plans or because of the retirement plans at their companies, which are often heavily invested in equities, in other words, in the stock markets. And so, therefore, this does matter. I know a lot of people say, you know, we feed this by, you know, treating it like a horse race. Well, in a lot of ways, sort of making money is a horse race. And, you know, it's sort of silly to think that you're going to, you know, basically gamble your retirement away and not pay attention to markets.
Well, we could use a few veterinarians at this point, that's for sure. Art Cashin, who's the oracle of the trading floor, who's been around forever on Wall Street, says that what's happening over the next several days is going to be talked about for generations. He sees a massive sell-off. And, you know, the global markets seem to be operating in lockstep here. Is this redemptions and capitulations, or is there some sort of strategic revaluing of all kinds of assets here, Jim?
Well, I think there's a little of both. First of all, there is a strategic revaluing of assets, and that is that people are finally facing up to the fact that, you know, what we saw in the bubble, I mean, basically the big run of stocks from about 2001 up until really last October, was in a lot of ways not real. In other words, as long as we had crappy accounting standards and really poor underwriting, in other words, really poor rules on who we would lend money to, it made money so easy to get that a lot of people made very easy gains, and that fueled a housing bubble that allowed a lot of people to say, value was whatever, you know, we were able to buy with cheap money. It turns out that that's not true value. That's sort of transitory value, and it's certainly gone, except it's gone much faster this time around. So the market is trying to step back now, and it doesn't believe any measures of value, and it's trying to come up with its own metric. There's no good metric for this in a panic, and so therefore people are just sort of throwing in the towel and saying, I want to be away from here. That would give you the opportunity to say, this is near the bottom, and maybe I can go in and buy something at a bargain. The problem is that's sort of the equivalent of trying to catch a falling knife.
Ooh, there's a metaphor. Jim, you know, Alan Greenspan said yesterday that there was a flaw in his model for how he believed the world works in trying to analyze what went on over the 20 years that he was the Fed chairman and then seeing what's been going on over the last few days. I mean, I'm not an economist, and I don't do what you do, but it seems to me on some level this is just a massively scaled up version of the SNL crisis where you had things that were valued in a kind of fantasy model. You have the Latin American debt crisis where things were valued in this kind of fantasy model and it eventually resulted in a bubble bursting. This is just a bigger bubble. It seems to me to say that there is some giant flaw in how the world works is ignoring what's in common between this crisis and other things that have passed by. Or am I wrong?
I agree with you that there are commonalities there in the sense that valuations went crazy. I think the difference that you know, Greenspan was talking about, and it's one of the big criticisms you can apply against him, is that, you know, Greenspan and a lot of people like Greenspan believe that markets inherently, you know, are, you know, sort of take care of themselves. They you know, wring out their own excesses, and that, you know, they bring in the collective wisdom of the society, you know, by getting all these price signals from millions of buyers and sellers, and that they then clean out their own mess. It turns out it doesn't quite happen that way, and he's been surprised that people were willingly, you know, they willingly walked into selling off things and securitizing loans that they knew were not good loans, and they still, because they could collect fees, passed those on. Now, the market shouldn't allow that, and so what he's saying is that he failed to realize that people were willing to do something that was truly bad, even when they had, you know, they suspected that it was truly bad, but that there was a enough money there to be made that they were willing to hold their nose and pass it along and hope that it wouldn't come back to them. Now he says that what should have happened is that you should have forced anyone who was going to sell off loans, package them and sell off these securities, to hold a significant portion of them, and that would have, you know, they would have had to keep some skin in the game, and that would have forced them to be much more diligent. That, however, is not how a free market person would ever believe.
But, Jim, given the enormity of where the economy is today, the world economy, is his disbelief, is that credible?
It is difficult to understand how someone who is so smart and who is so deftly managed the economy for so long, you know, made what a lot of people would consider to be a fairly simple mistake, which is that, you know, he expected the market to trump greed, while the market is truly driven in a large part by greed. The problem was that we had never quite seen anything like this. And if you have an inbred aversion to regulation, then you will tell yourself the market can take care of this and government will screw it up. And in this case, a little regulation, a little more regulation up front, which the Fed could have done. The Fed could have said you cannot, sort of value these securities the way you're doing it, or you have to hold on to a larger part of it.
Or just enforce the laws that are on the books. I mean, that's also a big issue that Christopher Cox from the SEC has acknowledged, that perhaps they weren't enforcing, the oversight wasn't as diligent as it should have been.
It's all a question of enforcement and also a question of how bad you think things can be. In other words, Greenspan has always believed that it's dangerous to try to stop a bubble. That, in other words, the government's role is to clean up after the bubble bursts. And that's a very large philosophical difference between him and Bernanke. Bernanke now admits that we have to think more about not letting bubbles get out of control, because in today's global market, you know, the consequences of a big bubble are a lot worse than they might have been 30 years ago.
The Earth is just a big bubble. Well, Adora and I get to start our weekend. Jim, you have to close an issue and get through Friday on Business Week. Thanks for joining us. Jim Ellis is Assistant Managing Editor from Business Week. He joined us on the phone from right here in New York. And that does it for us this week. One little thing I should point out, the PNC National City merger is the first big transaction of the U.S. Treasury using the TARP fund to buy so-called toxic assets. That may be a good side to all of this story today. One headline, anyway.
Thanks for that, John. We like good things. And here's a takeaway to think about.
This is like a Christmas present that arrived 2 weeks early. And you know what? Some of us just can't wait. They're opening the present. They're not waiting to put it under the tree.
That's the Christmas talk from Paul Gronke, chair of the political science department at Reed College. And he's talking about all of the excitement of early voters and all of these records that are just being broken in many states.
We are America's Exit Poll. We want to hear your stories on early voting. The experiences are available online and on the program at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway. Have a good weekend.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.